megawatts of solar, you'd have to put up 5 megawatts of natural gas too. And out of the woodwork came Texans, mostly rural Texans, saying, don't do this. This is how we pay for the schools in our county. You know, this is what keeps the old folks home open where we are. Do not do that. And they didn't. The Texas legislature just returned to its prime mission of redistricting in order to, you know, help the president. I'll tell you a story about the most beautiful thing in a way, not the most important, but the most beautiful that's happened in Europe in the last 3 years, which is the spread of this thing we're calling balcony solar for apartment dwellers. And this couldn't be easier. I mean, you just go down to whatever the Best Buy in Brussels is, and you come back with your solar panel for a few hundred euros, and it's designed to not go on the roof, you just hang it over the railing of your balcony. And then it just has a normal plug on the back that you stick in the wall. You don't need an electrician. You don't need to rewire anything. Often it provides 20% of the power that a small apartment uses. So it's not going to save the world, but it's an excellent gateway drug, and it can provide a fair amount of power. It's illegal everywhere in America, except that progressive bastion, the Deseret State of Utah, where by a unanimous vote of both houses of the state legislature, they passed enabling legislation earlier this year. Because some Republican state senator, who I've talked to and a good guy, just stood up and said, well, damn it, if it's good enough for the people of Stuttgart, it's good enough for the people of Provo. They shouldn't be denied the right to do this thing. And so now there's lots and lots of video on YouTube of earnest and smiling Utahns, you know, plugging in their balcony solar and gazing fondly at their app, showing the electrons hitting their... If that can be done in the state of Utah, surely it can be done in the city of Boulder or the state of Colorado in relatively short order. So y'all have your marching orders. We just need to organize. I'm just surveying some of the demographics in this room. So I'm going to talk for a moment about old people like me, okay? Those of us who have reached at least the age of 60, who we've organized in this group called Third Act, and I think there's some third actors here from the neighborhood, but we badly need the rest of you joining in, because we've turned in 3 years into a very effective fighting force of about 100,000 Americans who are taking this stuff dead seriously. They were the kind of organizing backbone of Sunday, though many other groups joined in. And we've done lots of other work, as we must, because otherwise our legacy is going to be a planet far worse than the one that we found. And because there are truly a lot of young people feeling really severe, what we call climate anxiety or climate despair. But in my experience, it's less because of the actual state of the planet and more because of the sense that they've been abandoned to deal with it on their own, okay? Which has been, in some ways, too true. It is time for those of us who've scooped the cream off the top to figure out how to make sure that we do what we can. And we can do a lot to make this happen. You know, it costs, we can't do anything in Washington right now. 18 months from now, maybe, and we're going to fight the midterms hard at Third Act. But right now, we can do tons at state houses and city halls. Costs three times as much to put solar on your roof in America as it does in Australia or the EU. Large part of that's down to the crazy level of bureaucracy. We have 15,000 municipalities in this country. Each has their own building code, their own team of building inspectors who would like to go climb on your roof. This is not really necessary. In the rest of the world, you can get a solar panel installed in a matter of days, not a matter of months, and at much, much lower prices. Happily, there's an app for that developed of course, by your neighbors at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, Solar App Plus. It allows for instant permitting for most rooftops. It's now mandated in California and Maryland, and as of last week, New Jersey. Colorado decided for some reason not to do it last year, but that's a mistake, one that needs to be righted. We need to be a little bolder than we have been in this regard because we are in an emergency. And so we should not worry quite so much about whether or not a solar panel might mar the historic roofline of a house. The thing that's going to mar the historic homes of Boulder is when they catch on fire and burn down, okay? So time to move with a little more dispatch. I've just sort of taken it as one of my tasks to sort of try and persuade my tribe of somewhat overeducated old white people to stop suing to block things they don't want to look at, okay? We need to push a little more aggressively. That's the end of my little sermonette. And I'll just end by returning to the part of all this that just deeply moves me. You know, I obviously stole the title of this book from George Harrison. And it turns out that when you go to Spotify, Here Comes the Sun is by far the most streamed song in the Beatles' vast catalog. Twice as many people a day listen to it around the world as Let It Be or Hey Jude or anything. And I think because in dark times, that gentle and optimistic song is very soothing. And I also think it's because human beings have a deep and powerful connection to the sun. We were putting together a playlist of songs for Sunday, and there were hundreds to choose from. Everybody who ever wrote a good song wrote one about, you know, Stevie Wonder did, and Bill Withers did, and, you know, just, you could just go on for hours. We had a list hundreds long. Somewhat longer than the list of great songs about fracking, you know. The sun is the most charismatic object in our corner of the universe, you know. We can't look at it directly, but if we don't get enough of it, we literally get sad, seasonal affective disorder, or whatever they call it. There's no human being I ever met who didn't grin involuntarily when the sun came out from behind the clouds and hit them in the shoulder blades, you know? And so the prospect that this star that already provides us with light and warmth and via photosynthesis with our supper is now willing to provide us with all the power we could ever ask for is just such a, I mean, I have a new grandson for the first time, so I'm, you know, deeply loved, someone who theoretically will hopefully be around in the 22nd century. So it is incumbent upon us to envision some way to make the 22nd century a possibility, you know. And this strikes me as one of the absolute key parts of allowing that to happen. I make no promises that we'll win this fight, because we don't know. We've waited very late to get started. But last spring before last, in Vermont, we had the path of the total solar eclipse came through Vermont. And so people from all over the eastern seaboard flooded into Vermont to watch. It was the biggest traffic jams in Vermont history. Even bigger than the last Fish concert in Vermont. But they were very happy traffic jams because everyone had had such a good time. I was on the quad at Middlebury College with 1,500 students, and they all put down their phones for a good half hour and watched this incredible spectacle play out. And it was just a reminder to me that we really don't want to be as alienated from the natural world as we've allowed ourselves to become. We don't know exactly how people back in prehistoric times thought about things, but we have some sense that the sun was pretty important to them, because every time we find a pile of stones like Stonehenge, it somehow points towards the solstice or the equinox, you know. That's who we could be. My mantra has become, you know, energy from heaven, not from hell. And I think that that's a world that it's at least worth trying to build. So thank you all very much for being a part of it. Thank you all. Now, I've rattled on longer than I should have, and we're going to go sign some books because, you know, supporting the bookstore really is a crucial. Those communities that took for granted their bookstores no longer have their bookstore, so it's good that you all have. But we have time for a few questions, and people have provided a few in advance, this list of questions. Some of which I think I've answered in going through, but I'll just take a look at a couple of these things here and see if there's some that I might want to add, and then we'll open it up, and if other people have things that they're curious about. One of the questions is, do we have land enough to make this happen? And the answer is, in this case, very much yes. It is going to take some land. We think Mark Jacobson at Stanford is the kind of leading authority here, says 1.5% of the surface of pretty much every country on Earth is sufficient in order to do this. And even most of that 1.5% is the land in between wind turbines in big farms. It's probably less than we're currently using for oil and gas. You guys have a sense of how much landscape is kind of off limits because there are gas wells and stuff dotted through it. But we are going to have to use some. And I think that's okay. We use a fair amount of land for energy right now. America's biggest crop is corn. We grow 60 million acres of it. 30 million acres of that corn is turned into ethanol, and that ethanol from that 30 million acres provides 3% of America's energy. If you took that same 30 million acres and covered it with solar panels, which we don't want to do because just carpeting Indiana and Iowa with solar panels seems unfair, but if we did, that 30 million acres would provide not 3% of our energy, but about 100% of the energy that we currently use. I got a real sense of this in an Illinois cornfield last summer when I was working on the book. And there's a farmer who was converting his land, and some of it, and he said, here's an acre that I have in ethanol, and that corn produces enough ethanol every year to drive my Ford F-150 25,000 miles. This acre I've turned to solar panels. It produces enough electrons every year to drive my Ford F-150 Lightning EV version of the same truck, not 25,000 miles, but 700,000 miles. That sort of hit home when he said that. Photosynthesis is a miracle, but not a very efficient one necessarily, at least in comparison. He also said, you know something else? To make those solar panels work, I do not need to pour large quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus on them that will then wash downstream into the Gulf of Mexico and create a large dead zone. I don't need to strafe them with herbicides and pesticides. In fact, having put up all those solar panels, I find myself left with half a field, the aisles in between the solar panels, which all of a sudden are the kind of tabula rasa for an entirely new field of human endeavor that we're calling by the very clunky name of agrivoltaics, which we definitely need a better name for. If you think about it, what a solar farm is doing is producing two things, electrons and shade. And on an overheating planet, shade is actually a highly valuable commodity. We're figuring out that there are lots of crops that you can grow more of when you're in that. I was just looking at the numbers from these French vintners who were saying that their Chardonnay grapes were yielding 60% more when they were grown amidst solar panels. Now, I'm a beer guy, so that does nothing for me. But there you go. In Vermont, what we're doing is putting, between a lot of them, just planting pollinator-friendly flowers and weeds, and the number of pollinating insects increases by about 100 times compared with the farm field that was there before, and that means that the orchards around there report 30-40% increases in fruit set, you know, because all of a sudden there's enough insects on hand to get their stuff done. When we get away from monocultures of all kinds, agricultural, energy, whatever, there's room for kind of interesting human creativity. I'm doing a bad job with these questions because I just keep... someone says, with the rapid uptake of artificial intelligence across all industries, do you see hope that these are just going to overwhelm the electric demand with these data centers? First of all, I think it's still a little unclear exactly how much energy all this is going to draw, because it's pretty unclear how much of a business case there really is for using AI, which so far is a fairly, its main use case so far is, helping your junior high school students cheat on their homework. It'll find some uses, but it's not at all clear that it's going to be the thing that its boosters hope. Microsoft is not building all the data centers they said they were going to build last year. Amory Lovins up at Snowmass has just put out a really interesting paper that I recommend, saying that it's really not going to be that big a part of our energy future. But if you're determined to build them, the only way to build them fast, which is what they all say they must be built in order to stay ahead of the Chinese, the only way to build them fast is with solar farms and wind turbines, because this is the only kind of energy that we know how to put up fast. If you want to put up a gas power plant now, turbines are in back order through 2030. If you want to put up a nuclear power plant, well, no one's going to do that before 2035 at best. And when they do, it'll probably be way more expensive than the relying on the very large nuclear reactor 93 million miles up in the sky. We can build solar farms in a matter of weeks, really days, as the Chinese are now demonstrating. So if we're going to do this, that's probably how we're going to do it. And I think with that, I managed to answer several of the questions at once that are on here. So I'm going to just, do we have enough time that we can shout out a couple more questions here? Is that okay? Only one. Is that what you're saying? We do have time for a couple. Okay. There, we'll start there, and we'll go to this side after that. Thank you. It's really important to just sort of think about all of you who, so many people in this room have worked so hard in the climate movement over the last decades. And for much of that time, most of that time, we were in a world where fossil fuel was cheap and renewable energy was expensive. And so the job in large part was to make fossil fuel more expensive. Carbon pricing, that's what that was about. Divestment to drive up the cost of capital, blocking pipelines to slow the consolidation of this industry, all in a sense to try and limit the fossil fuel industry and create a vacuum that would be eventually filled by clean energy. And now we live, as of a few years ago, in this upside down world where it's the clean energy that's cheaper and becoming more so all the time, and where now it's the fossil fuel industry that's trying very hard to limit it because it understands that it is an existential threat to it. And so now the job in many ways of the climate movement is to take this ball that's begun to roll downhill and just get behind it and push it with everything we have to make it roll fast enough that in this metaphor, I guess it will eventually flatten Exxon at the bottom of the hill and we'll be okay. But we need to keep doing all these things at the same time. And this is, in the end, ultimately a political fight, at least if we're going to make it happen in the time that we need it to happen. So I wish I could tell everybody that they were excused from working on all of this because economics would magically do it by itself, but it won't do it in time. Instead, what I get to tell you is that we now have a clear path that we have not had in the past that allows us to sort of see where we're going. It's a path, clear path lit by the sun. Yep. I think it's a very fine idea. Look, yes, I can. Would it be a good idea to call every politician you know and get on their butt about the solar app and balcony solar and so on and so forth? And yes, it would. Like, Colorado is obviously doing good things, and it's got a governor who's clearly committed to some of this work, and many thanks for it. And you've got excellent people and City of Boulder and in the county who have done tremendous work in really in some ways leading the country. And I'm so grateful to people who have done things like initiate these big lawsuits with the fossil fuel industry and on and on and on. But there's always more to be done. So in this case, I think an easy task, if only the people in this room called their legislators, I think the balcony solar thing is almost a gimme, you know, that there's enough people here because there's literally no reason not to do it, that's the kind of thing that can be done quickly and easily. And then when it's done, you have this beautiful image all over the place of stuff going in. You know, people can see by the hundreds and then the thousands and then the tens of thousands the apartment balconies with solar panels hanging off the roof. And so that's a beautiful place to start and well within the means of even just the people in this room to accomplish. But we'll be working hard on it at third act, yes, to see if we can get it done here as in other places. We just introduced the legislation last week in Vermont, and in Manhattan on Friday, the state assemblywoman who's in charge of the committee promised that she would, at the Sunday thing, that she would introduce it tomorrow. So time for Colorado to catch right up. Do we have time for one more? One more. All right. She lives in senior housing. And what's the clinching argument to convince people to jump in? The argument will be different for different people, okay? There's a powerful utilitarian and economic case to be made here about solar energy, and there will be people attracted to that. Some of the older men in the senior housing colony will love nothing more than the engineering task of playing around with solar panels, okay, and heat pumps and things. This is a perfect. One of the things we did on Sunday was have lots and lots and lots of homes across the nation opened for people to show their neighbors their heat pumps, and I know many gentlemen my age who. Nothing could have been more fun than talk about their heat pumps for a good hour and a half, okay? So there's some of them. But there's also, you know, plenty of people in your community who will be moved by a kind of moral or even sort of spiritual argument about this. I'm off to New York tomorrow for a couple of days, but then at the end of the week, I leave for Rome because the new Pope is hauling in a few people to talk about climate change on the 10th anniversary of Laudato Si. And by the end of the year, they broke ground on a big solar farm outside Rome a few weeks ago. By the end of the year, Vatican City will be the first fully solarized state on the planet. It is an odd thing to have reached the moment when the most progressive global institution on earth is the Roman Catholic Church, but there you are. But that's, you know, I think you can argue to people in your community that if the Vatican can accomplish this, so too can your community. Everybody's at the age where they have to start thinking about what the conversation's going to be like when they reach the pearly gates, you know? So this is very energy from heaven, not from hell. There we end. Many thanks, y'all.
You were just listening to Bill McKibben on the clean energy revolution. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late September. Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, is a leading environmental activist. He's the author of many books, and his latest is Here Comes the Sun. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as David Corton, Winona LaDuke, Amy Goodman, and Claudia de la Cruz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Bill McKibben on the Clean Energy Revolution, and for his book, Here Comes the Sun, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun, performed by the Petersons.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.
Listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours, sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Is Bird Note. The way that some birds flick, wag, or flare their tails can be as unique to a species as their song. A junco foraging on the ground rapidly flashes white tail feathers that normally remain hidden. When a song sparrow walks, hops, or flits from bush to bush, its tail flicks jerkily up and down. What's it all about? One reason is that a bird's repeated habitual movements communicate information, kind of like a person using hand gestures to signal to others. The tail flicking can also be used to deceive predators or to flush out prey. A flicking or flashing tail might suggest to a predator that a bird is particularly alert or hard to catch, while also warning others in the flock of danger. When a hawk dives at a flock of juncos, there is an instant eruption of white flashing tails, a visual yell, which may distract a hawk's aim at a single junco. A hooded warbler may flare its tail while foraging low to the ground to cause insects to jump, making them easier prey. While we often focus on their calls and songs, there's a lot you can learn about what birds are communicating by watching their tails. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.